Pack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It is the return of the Judges Table Podcast here at Reality TV Rahapas. Hi, everyone. I am Antonio Mazzaro. Nice to talk to you today. And I'm very glad you're listening to our recap of Top Chef Season 14, Episode 12, Cooking Away in Margaritaville. I am joined today by two of my favorite chivas, Mike Bloom and Kurt Clark. Mike, how are you?
Good. I am much more the GOAT than the G-O-A-T of this podcast.
The GOAT of this podcast may be Kurt Clark. Kurt, how are you?
I'm doing well. So if we're the girl and the goat, the Stephanie-owned Top Chef restaurant in Chicago, does that make Mike the girl?
I think Chivas means female goat. So yeah,
hey,
I think
together.
You're both on there. So there you go. Together again for the first time. Thank you again, guys. Hopefully you're ready to talk about this crazy episode of Top Chef in which we had a final three, then we had a final four, then we're back to a final three. It's Top Chef part finale, penultimate finale time. This is the way these things have been going in seasons, most recent seasons. So here we are again. So thanks to everyone for listening. If you're not familiar with what we do here at Reality TV Rahapups, we talk about all sorts of different reality TV shows. This particular podcast is about Top Chef, but our site covers, The Bachelor, The Bachelor in Paradise, Are You the One, Celebrity Big Brother UK. What else am I missing, Mike?
The Reality TV Happy Hour is going strong and will go even stronger when Big Brother Canada premieres next month. The Challenge is in its second week. Really, you are not deprived of any sort of coverage year-round here on Reality TV Rahapups. So if you're not already, make sure you're subscribed at robhetzawebsite.com/Rahapups, R-H-A-P-U-P-S.
And that will get you access to everything we do here at the website. If you want our Top Chef only podcast, you can go to robhetzawebsite.com/TC podcast for your iTunes link. You can also go to robhetzawebsite.com/Top Chef if you're using a different way to listen to podcasts. And that'll get you all of our Top Chef episodes from the season. We've covered every episode. We're going to cover every episode going forward. And we've covered it with a different panel. Mixed Josh Wigler, still not here this week. I'm not sure, guys. Do you think he's stranded somewhere in Mexico? Did he show up for a Last Chance Kitchen, lose, and then never get brought back?
You know, he's not at the soccer stadium.
Yeah, I would say check the floor of the Patron plant. Maybe he's in there somewhere.
Oh, he's like a little piece of chopped up agave. He's just using it as a pillow, and he's just trying to ferment his way into happiness. I think that's probably what's happening.
Is there nothing cuter than this, the image of a Josh Wigger curled up in the fetal position with around a bottle of tequila on the floor of a Mexican tequila plant?
I can think of a few cuter things, Kurt, but you're right. Okay. That's pretty high up the list. It's pretty high up the list. Yeah. Josh is not here this week. Mike, what's going on?
He might have also gotten left at the border as well. We're not entirely sure. We haven't tracked Chef Teston's journeys to Mexico from, you know, they left off in Charleston, but I'm assuming they went home for a portion of time before going back. So hopefully next week everything will go through with customs and Josh will be able to make his way south of the border to join the rest of us here as we analyze the final legs of Top Chef 14.
It's interesting because it's... I know someone had brought up the question early on, like, makes no sense that the finale for Top Chef Charleston is in Mexico. And I've been pretty, I'm fine with that. Like, I didn't really – once we saw that Top Chef California's finale was going to be in Vegas, I'm like, okay, whatever. They're going to go somewhere nice for the finale. But I think the absolute – So the absolute presence of Patron, and not to confuse absolute with the vodka, I think really made a lot of sense now, I think, in terms of like why we're in Mexico for the finale. I think we're going to be maybe analyzing a little bit more in future seasons how much a key sponsor may potentially influence the location of a finale. I wouldn't be surprised if next season's finale, we're going to be heading to a hidden valley somewhere to put these these chefs against one another. But I think that the Mexico finale is all making sense based on some of the elements of today's challenges.
It would be interesting if for season 15 for their finale they went to Texas, the heart of Texas, and just spent the entire three episodes on a ranch. I think that would be perfect with the Hidden Valley synergy.
Or if they just went to like Glad Family of Products Illinois or wherever, you know, set up shop.
Yeah, that famous township of Glad Family of Products.
Yes, Reynolds, Iowa. You know, like wherever, really. San Pellegrino, California. These are great cities that they could visit. So I'm sure that you're right, Kurt. I actually think that's an excellent observation. That this is not the first time that we've seen Patron this season, but this is just infomercial for Patron. It's like, here's how we make it. Here are the different varieties. Here's how you drink it. This is, I did not make me want tequila more. Kurt, are you a tequila man?
Ooh, boy.
Doesn't sound like it.
Well, you're asking me during the wrong week. I've had a lot of stomach issues between some drinking last weekend and a flu this week. I'll drink it. I think one of the last year I took my mom on her first cruise ever, and she experienced tequila for the first time, and she absolutely loved it. So I was drinking quite a bit of tequila then. But I like my alcohols. I really don't like to discriminate. I prefer not to have any of the Chicago-originated Malort, if possible, but tequila, I give a thumbs up to tequila.
Michael, what about you? A tequila man?
I am going to defer to the two of you a lot in this podcast when talking about the alcohol, because I'm really not that much of a drinker, and I am definitely not a tequila drinker. As Kurt seemed to allude to, I feel like everyone out there has that one tequila story, which makes you really stay away from the product for at least a good portion of time afterwards. And for me, that portion of time has lasted like 7 or 8 years up to this point. So I am fine staying away from it. That being said, you know, the Patron Hacienda looked nice and it looked stunning, but I would not be imbibing in their products anytime soon, which would actually make me probably a pretty good worker there, in spite of the fact that I could probably not chop up that agave, like that that really strong man that we got to see.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because you typically don't hear somebody saying, oh, I can't even look at vodka anymore, or you know, rum, you know, can't even stand it. Tequila seems to be that one kind of cursed liquid that a lot of people love, but that turns a lot of people off. But I do have to say, even though I think, you know, it was a Patron-heavy episode, at least for me, it didn't feel like intrusive product placement, because it was... I'm going to use the word edutainment and slap myself later, but I think it actually fit in there nicely, and I liked the extent to which Patron was featured in this episode.
It's like Escuela House Rock in terms of edutainment.
Exactly.
Sounds like you're going to have an interesting afternoon today, Kurt. Side note. Yeah, that is that's something that I think is Top Chef has done product placement. This is not something new. Whether it's a car or whether it's some kind of Glad family of products, Reynolds Wrap, Ranch, whatever it is, they've done product placement. This is not something unfamiliar with Top Chef. Yet this was like the Ocean Spray cranberry bog of Patron Tequila Haciendas. Like, this was a full location. You're seeing the way the sausage is made, if you will, and you're really getting a behind the scenes look at the product itself in different stages. And so whether or not it was product placement, I actually thought it was pretty cool. I mean, I don't know when I'm going to the Patron Hacienda, but I thought it was really neat to see them cut up the agave to mash it down, to ferment it, the distiller process. And then the aging process and how that produced different tequilas depending on how long. So most other alcohols, I'm a big bourbon guy, and I've been to all the bourbon trail kind of places here in my home state of Kentucky. So this was sort of nice to live vicariously through that. So I guess even if it's product placement, good job on Top Chef. I thought it was really fun to see. The title, not so much. Cooking Away in Margaritaville. I'm getting Jimmy Buffett chills over here.
I'm assuming Casey, in her tenure on Top Chef, was always searching for that lost shaker of salt, considering how much she's missed out on salt in a couple of her dishes previously.
Ah, that's a good... Mike, you came prepared with the Jimmy Buffett jokes. I'm really kind of surprised here.
My parrot head firmly ensconced on my noggin, ready to talk about this.
Can we talk about Jimmy Buffett? Who listens to Jimmy Buffett? No,
we can't.
Kurt,
no, we can't.
You're not a Jimmy Buffett man?
Save that for the Buffett cast, gentlemen.
Jimmy Buffett is like vastly popular here in Cincinnati. I have no idea why. He'll come and do like 3 or 4 sold out shows in a row. I don't know that he can do that anywhere else except for maybe like a yacht club in like Boca Raton or something. I don't know who likes the Jimmy Buffett. And I'm sorry if I'm running down someone's life, but this Jimmy Buffett is on the list with magicians for me, right, Kurt?
My best friend and his wife are huge Jimmy Buffett fans. I just can't. The three things I can talk to. We've already referenced two of them. Is like, you know, Margaritaville, check. Parrot Heads, check. We just haven't mentioned, is it Cheeseburger in Paradise?
That would be one.
We already had the dim sum cheeseburger in Paradise.
There we go. That's a completely exhausted my ability to talk to Jimmy Buffett. It's not that I can't stand Jimmy Buffett. It's just that it's literally this void in my pop culture ability to speak.
Isn't that why Fabio went home on Top Chef All-Stars, Mike? Didn't he screw up the Cheeseburger in Paradise challenge? for Jimmy Fallon.
Yes, absolutely. And he had to wear the Hawaiian shirt of shame. But I feel like the listeners are probably giving us a yellow card at this point for not, you know, getting to the beginning of this episode.
You mean there was a Top Chef episode. I got it. Yeah, that's funny. We were talking about Jimmy Buffett. John starts off making a Steely Dan reference. Apologies to John if you're listening, but man, don't date yourself, brother. and this is Steely Dan said something about something. We're here in going to Guadalajara. This is actually, it looks like an absolutely gorgeous city. Either of you guys ever spent any time in Mexico, specifically Guadalajara or other parts? Kurt, I feel like you might have.
Just like any place that might have been a cruise ship port of call, and unfortunately, Guadalajara, not one of those. But it did look like actually a really amazing place, and something that I definitely actually have added to my list of, if I ever do a tour of the country of Mexico, definitely some place to stop.
Mike, what about you? Any Mexican experiences in your life?
Outside of Once Upon a Time in Mexico, no, not at all.
Did I miss that episode, Mike?
Yes, you missed the spinoff, Kurt.
Yeah, that is a different show that you guys podcast about.
I knew there was Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, and we have referenced that many times during our Once Upon a Time podcast, but I missed the Once Upon a Time in Mexico telenovela.
I would love to watch that. That would get me hooked on your guys' Once Upon a Time podcast over at postshowrecaps.com. So I'll look forward to that. It seems like the chef testants are looking forward to this Mexican competition, although there is one sort of just elephant in the room, if you will, or giant floating dystopian 1984-like head in Shiva Stadium. In the winner of Last Chance Kitchen, it's Brooke. Guys, is anyone surprised that Brooke won Last Chance Kitchen? Kurt, we saw her ponytail in the teaser for last week's episode.
Oh, you are just trolling me now, man. Okay, look, and actually, but thank you. That as we saw during the episode, that was actually Emily's ponytail. So Chekhov's ponytail belonged to Emily, not to Brooke. So for all of you people who are like, it spoiled it. No, it didn't. It was Emily that we saw in the promo, not Brooke. So I was surprised that it was just like up there. I thought maybe it was going to like cycle through a bunch of pictures of people. Like we were going to see Brooke and then we're going to see Casey. And it was going to be like this little weird, Jumbotron roulette. But it just kind of, oh, and it's Brooke. And she comes in.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised, but very
anticlimactic for a myriad of reasons. One of them being, I think, purely by the cooking skills of the chef herself. I mean, I think the three of us even talked about at the end of the last podcast that we all assumed that Brooke was going to be coming back. No affront to Casey, but Brooke is just really up there in terms of cooking skill. And then, as you said, Kurt, to not even really do that much pomp and circumstance outside of, you know, putting Brooke up on the Jumbotron, which is equated to a Jumbotron that shows two people kissing every game.
Exactly.
They don't really measure up. But yeah, it was an odd reveal, and then she just sort of comes out. I guess, you know, they had a lot of stuff to get to, so they just said, like, okay, Brooke, you're back in the competition. Maybe it's because with Brooke coming back into the competition, we essentially reset to the beginning of the previous episode. I'm not entirely sure, but seemed a little rushed to me.
It had about the level of class of proposing to somebody at a football stadium, in terms of like, I would have much rather just had her and hear who your attorney is and just have her walk on the field. The Jumbotron just felt strange to me. I'm not saying like I either needed zero pomp and circumstance and just bring her out, or like let's like have her skydive in or something. The Jumbotron was just this weird neutral ground for me, like that just felt odd. But I'm happy that she's back. It's no less because that means that she's now on my team. I have stolen her from you, Mike.
It is, Kurt, a big moment for you. This is your sneaky pick in the Top Chef draft, the returning chef testant. Mike, this is a straight-up robbery. We should have protested more about this rule before the season started, because Brooke went from your team to Kurt's team in seemingly the blink of an eye.
Even when I win, I lose, but that's just the Mike Bloom MO, so I guess I'm used to it at this point.
You've still got Sheldon, though, right?
I do. Yeah. I still have Sheldon, though. We'll definitely talk about, you know, Brooke, I think, almost needed to be eliminated. She almost vocalizes that when she comes back into the competition, because she proceeds to win both challenges this episode. I'm still sticking to my prediction that we made at the end of the last podcast of Brooke beating Sheldon in the final two.
We have seen chefs come back from Last Chance Kitchen and then immediately win the quick fire in the past. It has happened. This is not something new. There may be something to this, what Brooke is saying, in that you come in with your expectations lowered, not necessarily in terms of how you expect to do, but in terms of how that elimination was going to affect you. It wasn't, it turns out, the end of the world. It's going to be different for the person that's eliminated in this episode, obviously, and maybe that's not fair, but they do make it to the final three before they go. So this is something different where you were eliminated. The thing you feared the most happened and you didn't actually die. You're still in the competition. So at that point, you're cooking with what Brooke talks about this episode, with just a confidence or an air of not inevitability, but an air of just not even invincibility. Just like the thing I feared the worst happened, I'm still around. So now I can cook without the fear of that, like ending my life. It's interesting because we're at a point in this season now, and we're talking about essentially four redemption stories, if you will. Shirley mentions it this episode. Like, I want to go further than I did when I went home in my season. John has been talking about that all season. I went home 7th or 8th on my season, and it devastated me. I want to make it to Restaurant Wars. I want to make it to top 5, top 4. So he makes it to the top 3. He's done better than he did on his previous season. But, Mike, as you observe, if we see a Sheldon versus Brooke finale, one of those two is not going to win. I mean, the only way that we have a redemption arc or everyone did better arc on this season of these last four is if Brooke does beat Sheldon in the finale. If Sheldon beats Brooke, Brooke gets to the point where she did before and doesn't do better. And Sheldon succeeds and Brooke is still the one left out. So I think there are some interesting stories left to tell here on this season of Top Chef. It was sad to see Chef John go. I'm not going to jump around, but it was just, I don't know if it was telegraphed from the beginning here. I don't know if you guys felt that way, but it certainly seemed like the Brooke dominating this episode was definitely telegraphed. She just came in on fire.
She definitely came in on quick fire here. Definitely more the GOAT than the GOAT. But I will say that we'll definitely talk about, you know, John's subsequent downfall and elimination later. But I think I speak on behalf of all of us where if you were given this group of four chefs without even knowing what the challenges were and said, okay, point to the person that you think is going to be going home, I think we would all point to John, and that's not a disservice to him as much as it is a service to the other three, which have been extremely strong. I mean, I would consider this final three to be up there with, like, season 6, season 12, in terms of, like, just pure cooking strength. They're really out of this world, and John is great, too, but John, remember, is the only one out of these four who has never experienced going to the finals before. I mean, he calls himself an underdog later on, which is so crazy considering that he has the most cooking experience out of all of them, but he also has not been through this part of the competition, whereas the other three of them have to varying degrees.
But I don't know how much different this part of the competition is. I mean, it's another cooking challenge. And if you're a good cook, you're a good cook. So I don't know if I want to add the fact that he hasn't been to a finale to something that is like working against him at this point. I'm sure he's cooked under many levels of stress before in the past. And actually, and again, I'm going to tap into my goldfish memory here in terms of just not having history around what Shirley's experience is with Mexican cuisine. But when I kind of saw that the lineup and I saw that John was paired with Katsuji, and I know that John's experience as a Texas chef and that there was going to be some Mexico influences in this challenge, I actually didn't have him pegged as going home this episode. I was thinking that we might actually see Shirley go home. But that's just kind of where I stood. But again, it was more from like the type of cuisine and potential familiarity. It could very well be that Goldfish Brain Kurt does not remember the fact that Shirley knocked every single Mexican cooking challenge out of the park in her original season. But that's kind of where my head was at going into this episode.
Well, there is a delay, right? There's a break, a small break between, and sometimes it's weeks or a larger number of weeks between the finale and the city where they go, and then the next step of the finale. There's a little bit of a break, and we've heard in the past about that break occurring right before the final episode too. So we have heard a lot. I mean, we saw what happened with Gregory in that season where he kind of, during the break, decided that he wanted to go do something different with his food. And I don't know if that's a good idea or a bad idea. He went and studied a bunch of stuff and was looking about that was, of course, season 12. And I think that that's the last time that we went to Mexico, right? And Gregory went and did a bunch of studying on flavors, and that worked really well in, I think, this episode. The second part of the finale. The first part of the finale was what I was talking about in Top Chef Mexico, where Dougie comes back from the Last Chance Kitchen. He immediately wins the quickfire and then immediately wins with his Texas Red in that artistic-inspired challenge where they each got paired with an artist. So he goes double-double in that episode, and then Gregory goes double-double in the next episode. But then in the finale, Gregory cooks. He had been cooking Thai flavors all season, and he kind of cooks a mix of Thai and Mexican, and May wins the finale because Gregory got away from his food. So I do think the time away sometimes causes chefs to look into, if you'll remember in that season as well, May was like, I worked on the pastry line at a restaurant because I wasn't really a pastry chef. So I worked on, and I worked with the pastry chef at our restaurants learning how to do more desserts. And she ended up making a dessert that was really well liked and she won. So there is time for chefs to start to second guess themselves, to look into maybe the cuisine of where they're going and to try to be inspired by it. If anything, it felt like John went home not for that, but for maybe making a cocktail that he already knew how to make that was a little too basic for what was going on and maybe didn't go well with the dish that he made. So it doesn't seem like one of those scenarios where anybody was really in their own heads too much, and that's why they went home. It actually seemed like they said that all four chefs cook pretty good dishes. Tom really liked John's dish. We'll get into all of the specifics of the elimination challenge, but I do feel like it was pretty clear from the start that some heads were in the game pretty heavily here. And we walk into Shiva Stadium, the home of the Shivas. I think it's like the Club Deportivo Guadalajara is ultimately what they're called. And they're the most popular Mexican soccer team. If you're a fan of soccer at all, you've definitely heard of this club. They really have an extensive history, tons and tons of fans. I think that stadium holds like somewhere between 40 and 50,000 people. It's a huge, huge stadium. It looks amazing. It's a really cool place, I think, to do this final challenge. And Mike, can you set up who these who was the guest judge here? Was this Blue?
He did not step out of an old Popeye cartoon playing on a boomerang on Mexican TV. No,
this was a quite a barrel-chested man.
He looks extremely strong. He looks like he had just gotten over like chopping some agave in the Patron Hacienda. But this is Francisco Ruano. He's a Guadalajara chef. I believe Shirley brought up that like he's one of the first chefs to really put Guadalajara cuisine on the map. It's one of these other weird cases, too, of these episodes where there's different guest judges for the quickfire and the elimination challenge. We're going to see, you know, Francisco get replaced by two chefs, probably because they're put together could be the size of Francisco in the elimination challenge. So he's only here for this one. Him and Tom are both sporting what it looks like Chivas polos, but they're there to talk about some goat.
They're there to talk about some goat, Kurt. The Chivas is the goat. Sheldon laughs. The mascot of Chivas is a goat, and they're going to cook it. And they have 45 minutes essentially to make a goat dish. Have you eaten goat before?
I think you mean goat.
Oh my god!
Yeah, sorry. that went about as over as well as Tom's goal.
I think
did.
Yours went over better for some reason.
Yes.
Is goat something that's been on your menu before?
It's not been in my Blue Apron menu, but I'm trying to think. I have to imagine I've had goat cheese, but I think many of us have. I don't know if I've ever eaten goat before. I'm trying to think if I've ever had like a goat empanada or something. I will try at literally anything. So it's not something I wouldn't have tried because it was like, oh, goat. I've had like zebra before. I'm going to say I have to have had it at some point in the past. I just can't recall.
It seems like the closest comparison protein wise, at least from a texture standpoint, is from my perspective, venison, at least, because Sheldon immediately says that it's known for its toughness, and that's why people don't really like it. So I'm with you, Kurt. I'm sure I tried it at some point as part of some sort of meal that I just don't remember, but it seems like with the exception of the cheeks, which Sheldon decides to go after for the tenderness, goat is usually known for being a little tougher than maybe, you know, some of its other farm wide brethren, like a lamb or a pig.
Yeah, between Sheldon saying how it's like he's really searching out for like a super tender part, and Shirley mentions that it's normally a 2-day prep. And even when Brooke goes to for some ribs, she's like, you know, you kind of get this voiceover, like there's not a lot of meat on the ribs necessarily. So at the very least, it seems like it's a very difficult protein to work with.
Yeah, I've had, and not made, I mean, I've just gone to a restaurant here in Cincinnati, a Jamaican restaurant, and had curry goat, and I don't know what the prep on that is. I apologize. I don't know if that's a, you know, if you take that meat and you cook it for a really, really long time, like brisket is not a great tender meat until you cook it so slow and so long, and then it becomes what it is. So I don't know if goat is one of those things where the way that you would normally eat it has been super slow cooked. My guess is that it would be. And that's probably why it doesn't present that way in the ways that I think it's popular. But in this 45 minutes, I mean, that's the difficulty of the challenge, right? You have to take a gamey meat. You have to take a meat that seems, as you're observing, Mike, difficult to work with and make something really stand out in the 45 minutes. And that's really the only instruction that's given, right? Like you don't have anything else that you have to do. You're just basically making a goat dish and that's it. And in a return, if you win, you get an advantage in the challenge. Plus you get $10,000 in ranch bucks or whatever Hidden Valley's doling out here.
Yeah. Can't wait to go to Hidden Valley Ranch Land where you can spend all those ranch bucks and ride the rancher coaster.
Yeah, the ranch. Yeah, if you pay, like, you get a giant stuffed bottle of Hidden Valley Ranch with the tickets that you turn in. So I don't know, this is $10,000, which is a nice win and an advantage in the elimination challenge, which we'll talk about. Sheldon's going to use the cheeks of the goat for the tenderness and make a stew with a charred salsa. Shirley is trying to do a 2-day goat cook in 45 minutes in a pressure cooker with a soup noodle. And she's really going all out. Like, her dish sounded really interesting to me, and I was excited to see how that all played out. John was making a torta. And again, I do think this is an example of someone coming into the finale with, okay, I've read up, John says, about the food here. I'm going to try to approximate the food here. And I think safe to say he probably does not finish in the top two in the quickfire here.
I mean, I saw the torta and I was like, that is a lot of bread. And that
seems to be you could see the torta because all I saw was just a flood of red sauce. I didn't even see a sandwich in there.
Oh, I thought I just saw like a huge crispy baguette. I can't know what kind of bread it was, but to me, the comment that the ratio of the bread to the meat was off. I said it did. Like even Brooks or not Brooke, Padma said, you know, this is a pretty big bite you're giving us. It did look like it was a monster of a sandwich to tackle.
Well, to be fair, it looked delicious to me. It looked like a meatball sub, and I was all
yes,
about it.
I wanted to try it. I'm not against a big bite, and we're just going to move on from that comment.
Yeah, and John made use of the Arbo chili to make a hot sauce, which was really good. And Shirley, they really liked the sourness of the dish. She used like a Huila Coche radish, so she's bringing in the radish from the humble radish from earlier in the season. Huila Coche is an interesting ingredient. We've seen it come up on Top Chef before. I've seen it referenced in other places. I've had it in dishes in Cincinnati here. It's like a corn fungus that is a delicacy, so it's an interesting... Well, I mean, yeah, you laugh. It's like a corn mushroom, Kurt. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
I'm just saying the term corn fungus. I mean, needs a little bit of PR work. That's all I'm saying.
Well, when I first heard it, someone told me it was corn smut, and I don't know. Ooh. Do you think that corn fungus is a better term than corn smut? Yeah.
No.
Let's not talk.
I like the corn smut.
Mike, don't say corn porn, or we're just going to cancel the podcast. All right.
This is withdrawn.
This is something where ultimately Shirley's using interesting ingredients. They're all using kind of chili or some kind of local. There's a lot of salsas involved. They're really, I think, doing a good job of bringing the cuisine forward. Brooke, on the other hand, like Brooke is going like full on. She's like making this amazingly juicy. I mean, you can see it dripping as the guest judge. Mike, you sound like you're drooling as we're talking about it.
This looked so good to me. And again, it might be my personal preference because I think if I looked at all four dishes, as much as I would love a goat ball sub or whatever the torta was, the ribs, I'm a sucker for ribs and they look great. And I love, you know, Francisco brings up about how he was concerned about, you know, her pairing it with, you know, a mango and papaya salad. But it paid off really well. Like, you know, I'm assuming, you know, the freshness of the fruit really combated the juice of the meat. And this also is this idea of, I guess the ribs were brushed or prepared with chamomile, which sounds so interesting to me. You know, I feel like ribs are usually in a sauce or in a marinade that's sweeter, that's, you know, more sugary. I guess this is going more the bitter route of the chamomile tea, even though chamomile is probably the least bitter of the teas, but it just sounded so good and it looked so good. So it makes sense to me as to why this was the clear victor of the match.
And it's like, as they're doing the judging, this is something that I kind of keep an eye on throughout the season. It is the questions that are asked during the tasting. And like, and I always try, as I take my notes, I take note, like, what is the dish and where are the judges' comments? And sometimes in the quick fire, they'll give you some comments, but it seems to have like a lot more like, almost like loaded questions. And when they're trying Brooke's ribs, they ask, you know, why she used fruit in the dish. And just my personality, it's like I hear that and I almost read it as like an accusation, and I thought that they maybe weren't agreeing with that choice, but it turns out no, they actually thought it was a nice a really nice component of it, and it was a and it was like it added this kind of amazingness to the dish that they hadn't expected. So
now,
let's
save the accusations against Brooke from the guest judges for a little while from now in the episode.
Yeah, we'll get into that. We have to get into that. And there's just no escaping that that aspect of it. It's almost the elephant in the room at this point. It's so offensive to what we're going to talk about. Well, we'll talk about that later. Unfortunately, they all wanted some more time in this quick fire, but everybody seemed to do pretty well.
Yeah, they did.
There are some issues, obviously, anytime you rush something, but I think that Brooke really did seem to cook the right dish. Mike, you mentioned all these flavors and combined. We recently went to Pok Pok Thai restaurant in Brooklyn together, and we had like a green papaya salad with coconut rice and sweet pork, and that was so good. And I think of these, like, Brooke's flavors are just so amazing this episode. Like, she just puts things together in this episode that really seemed to pop off the TV screen, and shouts to her. I mean, like, she did a really good job, even though it seemed like other chefs cooked really good on this episode. Brooke really just ran rampant, and so she wins the challenge. Not only does she get the ranch bucks, she gets to pick her choice of four returning sous chefs. Kurt, the everyone's favorite four chefs from the seasons are back.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience at this point. Well, here's the thing. So yeah, we get back Casey, Emily, Silva, and Katsuji. Not in that order, but like, these are the last four chefs who were eliminated. I almost would have rather seen the last four chefs standing in Last Chance Kitchen. I think all that would have changed would have just been that Jamie was in there and Katsuji would have been out. Is that correct?
I think that's right, Mike. I think that that's ultimately how that would have proceeded.
Yeah, it would have.
Right?
Yeah, it's simple, just because Jamie eliminated Katsuji. It's as simple substitution as that.
Yeah, right. And even just given that, I think that as much as I like Emily and she was on my team, I think we needed Katsuji to come back for this as a chef tested. So I don't know what logic he could have used there, but I think I'm just missing. I would have liked to have seen Jamie come back.
I don't know. Katsuji looked like he was on his way to like give an ad pitch on Madison Avenue with his 3-piece suit. He didn't look ready to cook.
That's how he dressed all season.
Yeah, he's such a dandy.
No. There's a difference between wearing a bow tie and a button-down shirt and wearing a 3-piece suit on a soccer field in the middle of Mexico. Clear difference, in my opinion.
It doesn't help that he sauntered onto the field with his hand in his pocket. You know, that was really a great entrance by Katsuji. Everything in its right place there, and really well orchestrated for Katsuji's dandy return to Top Chef. It was not something that was ultimately well received by John. Almost immediately, John's like, "Be nice, Brooke. Be nice." I don't want this to happen. That's our biggest conflict of the season, one of the biggest stories of the season, and here we are. It's right in our face. We're revisiting the epilogue that we didn't know we needed or we deserved or that was coming. We get John and Katsuji part two, because Brooke gets to pick. Of course, she picks her friend Casey. They went together really well all season. They had the story in Last Chance Kitchen. They seem to go and work together really well. Casey is basically her sister, for lack of a better comparison, as we saw with with the loved ones visit last week. So Casey and Brooke make a natural pairing. Brooke then gets to choose who to pair the rest of the chefs with. I'm interested in Kurt. You're a big strategy game guy. Do you think that there was real strategy in this? And do you think this was the right strategy, how this ultimately played out?
Well, see, here's the thing. Like, if I probably would have given, but looking at Emily, Silva, and Katsuji, I would have given Silva to the person that I thought was my was not my biggest competition. And for some reason, I'm thinking Brooke thinks that Shirley is her biggest competition. So, you know, if you're playing nice, and I do get the sense that you know Brooke and Shirley are looking out for each other. I think that was more like I want these people to make good dishes. I'm not looking for conflict to happen here. So I think that just. I think that's the perspective from which Brooke was approaching this. I think whoever you put Silva with is just going to make them stronger. I think Emily is going to be a good worker, and that's what she did. But Katsuji is going to be kind of that force that's going to bring you down, just to be completely honest. And not in terms of his skills, but just in terms of having to manage the personality. And I don't know. I think out of all of the people, I think John can maybe handle Katsuji the best. So I think that Brooke potentially did the least damage by putting Katsuji with John, but she probably helped John's game the least by giving him Katsuji.
It is, Mike, kind of interesting that Katsuji should be seen as an advantage here because of his familiarity with the flavor profiles, because of his ability to speak the language. I mean, there's a lot going on for Katsuji, and there's a reason why he might be a good pick. If I recall, this is not the first time that Katsuji has been available as a pick on a season like this, where we go to Mexico and we have the possibility of somebody getting assistance from somebody who's a returning chef. And so I don't know whether there was any game theory in it or not. And I think that it could certainly read that way, because Katsuji did go with the chef that he had the most conflict with on the season. I think, Kurt, you're probably right to assume that someone with the experience of managing the most conflict with Katsuji might be able to handle it. But there is this definite issue between John and Katsuji when Katsuji walks up, Mike. And Katsuji seems to feel like John is the reason that he went home. Is that the way that it was presented to us as viewers? Do we, looking back on that elimination, did we feel that way at the time, or do we feel that way in hindsight, that John was the reason that Katsuji went home?
I know these are not part of the same conjunctions, but Katsuji is treating this like a because of John when it really was an or John. I mean, we talked about that during the Restaurant Wars episode, that you can make an argument for either John or Katsuji to go home. But I think Katsuji, you know, even though I think they're a few weeks or months removed at this point, he still believes that because of John's wonky expediting system, as a result, you know, he got major flack for his dishes and went home. Antonio, I know you said this is one of the stories of the season. Personally, I did not need to see this again. And because, you know, in the first few episodes, again, I'll say that, like, Katsuji was acting like an ass, but, you know, I was saying, oh, this is part of his personality. He's a playful ass at the end of the day. I will refrain from using that phrase anymore for the rest of this podcast, but this was just, I don't know if he was playing it up for the camera. I don't know if he really was just feeling that much resentment, but oh my God, this. He was a douche. He was a big this episode. And
whoa,
he was. I'm going to say it. I mean, no, he was. When John's in the kitchen later, when John's telling him, you know, giving him instructions and saying, you know, thank you, and he turns his back and Katsuji just mutters under his breath, F you, John. Unnecessary. Why the hell did you need to do that if only just to play up your character for the cameras? I did not need to see this whatsoever. I hated watching it. We don't need drama at the Final Four. I just want to see people cook good food. Even though it's complicated, though, because as you said before, Katsuji, you know, brought in this Mexican history into John's dish, and I believe John's biggest acclaim for his dish came from the elements that Katsuji added, so it complicates things a bit. So even though it was nice to see Katsuji there and help John a little bit, even though it was sort of all for naught at the end, I didn't need to see us keep rehashing this conflict for the next 40 minutes.
And I think especially because it seemed very much like a one-sided conflict. I mean, it wasn't
exactly.
I mean, yeah, God bless John for, like, live and let live. And it's true. I see it's easier from his perspective because he wasn't the one that was eliminated in Restaurant Wars. But I think you're completely right, Mike. It wasn't a John caused Katsuji to get eliminated. Both chefs were on the chopping block. Both chefs had reasons they could have gone. And the judges chose to, you know, put more weight on what Katsuji did wrong than John's errors during that episode. And Katsuji's errors weren't due to John. So it was completely... Even then, it was like, you know, kind of a one-sided reason why he left. But while I don't necessarily have the same level of fervor as you do for the story this episode, I save that for things like Edgic and edits. I did feel like it was. Maybe it was because of the one-sidedness. Like, John was just completely, you know, let's do this. And it was being magnanimous in terms of you know, I just want to make this work, and how can we move past this? And Katsuji was giving him nothing. But let's just move on with the cooking.
Well, look, there should be an advantage to it in some ways.
Yes,
Doug thought there would be when Doug took Katsuji. Doug went home that episode. He went home that episode
in part. The curse of the Katsuji.
He went home in that episode in part because he got the escamoles. He had the ant eggs or whatever, and he was just not. It was just not going to happen. And he wasn't really super familiar with how to make that the star of the dish. He had a really difficult time with it. And that was not through the fault of Katsuji. There was no conflict between the two of them. It seemed like the right call throughout the episode. Katsuji was crushing it for him. And then it just didn't work. So I don't think that Katsuji's the reason that John went home this episode, so there's a lot of useless conflict for ultimately something that doesn't really play into the challenge. As you point out, Kurt, like, I think Katsuji brought the only really good thing about not really good thing. I mean, Tom said that John's dish ate really well, but he brought the only good thing about that cocktail into the mix and saved it from being very basic. So there are some pluses and minuses. It did seem one-sided. I understand what you're saying, Mike, without using the same words, that Katsuji was coming off like a jerk. He was even aware. He was like, I can't sabotage you because I'll look like an ass. I think there's a couple things to speak about, not in Katsuji's favor, but maybe in his slight defense that I can't help the lawyer in me. I can't put it aside. First of all, we don't know what actually happened in that Restaurant Wars episode. We only know what we saw on television. Second, I don't think Katsuji had seen the episode on television by the time that aired. It was probably still very fresh, and he probably hadn't seen the times where he did screw up or how it was presented to the public. So it maybe seemed like the reason he went home was that John threw him under the bus, and maybe that is ultimately what happened. I don't think that's the way it was portrayed on the show. I think it was portrayed on the show like Katsuji did three dishes. He was in over his head. There were some good ones. There were some bad ones. But ultimately, he eschewed the responsibility, even though he had won the quickfire, of being executive chef or doing any kind of front of housework, and decided just to cook. And he tried to make up for that by cooking a lot. And the judges saw right through it. They questioned why he passed the buck. And they thought him blaming John for the poor service was ultimately his fault, because it was his choice to not be the executive chef. So I don't think Katsuji, at least on the show, was presented as going home because of John. But there was certainly a lot of conflict there. And it's certainly conflict that was pretty raw. And we don't even know what we didn't see. So I don't know if we didn't see something where it felt more like Katsuji might have went home because of John. If anything, it felt like to me, the way the episode presented it when Katsuji went home, was that Katsuji went home because of John not helping him enough. Even though John was shown to be helping him, they showed John taking however long to crank out his own pimento cheese dip dish, and then helps Katsuji with a couple of things. He had the tomatoes chopped up and ready. He was helping him get certain things set, but maybe there was an expectation that John would do more. And then John's real failure that episode was the expediting, which hurt their team, but not necessarily Katsuji. So I don't know where the real issues lied between the two of them, but you're right. It was still very fresh with Katsuji. He jumps right in on John. I hated you for a while. You threw me under the bus. John, as you're right, Kurt, like, takes the graceful kind of way out and tries to be taking the high road about it. Katsuji and I are great. We're working well together. It couldn't be more clear than when the chefs are all sitting down to prep their menus. We hear them going over their dishes, and the challenge that they're given is, is they have to, they're going to the Patron Hacienda, right? They have to see how the tequila is made, and then they're going to pair the tequila. They're going to make a cocktail and pair it with the dish. They want the dish to have all the same flavor profiles as the tequila. So you really have to hit the bitter, the sweet, the salty, the sour. And I got to say, when John picked Katsuji, he got the sour, the salty, and the bitter right off the top.
Well, let's talk about that challenge, though, because I know we had a couple of listeners maybe take a little fault with it. And they might be painting with a broad brush when they were telling us, you know, why did they have an elimination challenge that had the chef testants serve as bartenders, ostensibly, by having them, you know, create drinks. What did you guys think of it? Do you think it was really outside the realm? Do you think that they needed to add this gimmick in, or should they have just let them cook and not even involve the tequila in any way?
Being able to manage flavors and to combine flavors and pair flavors well, I think, is an important aspect of the challenge. I mean, I've not had issues in the past when we've seen top chef testants have to create ice cream. And you know, you're one step away from there being a liquid in a drink when you're making ice cream. And so it's, I don't know, I think it's, and lots of the ingredients that you would put into a drink are things that you're going to incorporate in cooking as well. So I think understanding the different ways that those ingredients can be used and how things go together is a key element. And the fact that it wasn't like some of the chefs were being asked to do this and others weren't, I had absolutely actually no issue with this. If it was being judged purely on a drink, then I would have an issue with it. I actually don't think that John went home purely because of his cocktail, but we can talk about that at the elimination. But I thought there was nothing untoward about the parameters of this challenge.
It didn't seem untoward to me either. It's tough. It seems like an odd time for this to come up with the only four chefs left, because we talk about the skills that are required from a chef, and we've seen this before. I mean, famously, there have been chefs in the past on Top Chef who this was probably their greatest skill in terms of like cocktail pairing or mixology or bringing these things together. We've seen that be like a standout skill for different chefs that have been brought back even. So we don't know, and I'm thinking of Steven from season one, who came back
the
on
best,
All-Stars.
The best top sommelier that existed on the show.
Right, and other chefs have done a good job with this. We see it a lot with the Terlato wines. We've seen them require pairings before. I don't recall ever seeing it happen this late in the competition, and I do think it's difficult. We hear these chefs say, like, I don't know, you know, Sheldon seems to specifically be the one singling out that he's not really a cocktail guy. He's not a mixologist. I think we've seen Sheldon work with alcohol on Top Chef before. Somebody can remind us of when exactly that happened this season. But I know Sheldon has this ability, but maybe pairing is not the best skill, and that's a difficult thing to do.
But I would argue that, like, the Steve and the sommelier is a completely different experience, because there you have a wine. You can use wine in cooking, but it's not one of the main ingredients. Here you're making a cocktail out, and you can put into that cocktail ingredients that you can also put into your dish. You have a lot more flexibility here in terms of creativity versus taking looking at tasting, you know, eight different samples of wine and figuring out which pairs best. Here, you can kind of adjust things and see how things taste good together. So I think it's a bit of a different comparison in pairing a wine with a meal than creating a cocktail with and having it go well with a meal.
It's a bit of apple liqueur and orange liqueur in terms of the comparison, if you will. I agree with it. I do agree with you, Kurt, that I think, you know, this does allow for an opportunity in creating your own drink as opposed to pairing it with an already made drink. You mentioned the wine before. I believe there was a quick fire way back in the day where they had to, like, pair with a type of vodka, bringing up Absolut, as you mentioned before, whereas here they're really creating a drink that they can use to sort of really pair the dishes together. But I agree with Antonio, at least where I don't know if we needed this late in the competition. I think at this point in the finals, I think what a lot of Top Chef fans are saying is do away with the gimmicks. Let's just have them cook what they want to cook. And I know, Kurt, you probably don't think that this is really a gimmick. It's just really an extra thing that's added on to the challenge. But I mean, I'll spoil next week's promo. So if you're a spoiler phobe, get out of here, even though we know who's back at this point for the next, like, 30 seconds. But it looks like next week they can't cook with any tools during the elimination challenge. I don't know if I need to see that at the final four, final three. This might be fine, this like pairing with the margarita challenge, but when we're getting to stuff that you could see in quick fires in episode 5 in the final four and the final three stages of the game, I don't know if I need to see that as opposed to just having them cook the best dish they possibly can.
I don't need to see that till the final cook. I need some sort of twist or challenge at Final Four and at Final Three, personally.
Well, I got a great show for you, Curtis, called Cutthroat Kitchen on Food Network, where you can assign those things to each other.
I used to watch that all the time. I can see an argument being made for, let's have the quickfire challenge be pairing a margarita with a simple local Mexican flavor, and maybe having the challenge itself focus more on cooking. I can see an argument about that, but I have less of an issue with it. I mean, Patron's been this is the other thing. Patron, we talked about chefs doing their homework. Patron's been a sponsor all season. It's had a heavy visibility throughout Charleston, and then they know that they're going to Mexico for the finale. You have to at least suspect that Patron is going to feature in that, and you may have to be called to use Patron in a drink. So at the same time that you may not have been prepared for it, it's something that you could have potentially seen coming. I still have absolutely no issue with the challenge.
And I'm kind of in the middle in that I don't like my issue is ultimately I'm on your team, Kurt, in that I don't mind seeing a little bit of a hook for the final four here, because we're going to go final four. We're going to go final three. Then we're going to go head to head for final two. And so you can't just do best dish three times in a row. However, I understand that pairing and cocktails, and especially now there's this whole movement. It's happened in the last several years of these really, fantastically modern cocktails or modern takes on old recipes. It's a thing that is very prevalent in cuisine these days. And what I would say is, I don't think it's not a skill that chefs are meant to have. Like, I do think that chefs have to work on contemplating cocktail pairings and things like that with their menu. It's not the same as wine. It's a different thing. I'm not sure that that's a skill that I want to see tested at this late stage in the competition. I think I would have rather seen this when there was more room for error, because it didn't seem like all four chefs, I should say, made knockout cocktails. It didn't seem like that was something that all four chefs did a really, really, really good job with. And so ultimately, I don't know that they really showed everything they could show as chefs in terms of this challenge. I think the cocktail part did hold them back a little bit. And that's the part that I'm frustrated with, is I understand it's a skill. I'm not sure it's a skill I need to see tested at this stage of the competition. I don't mind a hook. I don't mind gimmicks. So I'm not with everyone else there. I'm just not sure I like this one.
Well, I was going to say, so in season 15, when we have our Hidden Valley finale and they're asked to make a dip at the final three, are you going to be upset?
Of course I will. Yeah. Okay. Like, of course I will. Okay. Yeah. Like, especially if we're in San Pellegrino, California, like, put some mineral water in there. But yeah, this is just something where I think it's just the nature of that particular thing. Even if they were told, and we already did it this season, right? We already had a use Patron in your dish challenge this season. So that was in the mystery box, right? So I don't know ultimately whether or not we needed another Patron challenge, even though the opportunity to go to the Hacienda is too good to pass up. There's probably a better way to do that. But here we are, cocktail pairing at the final four. And the cocktail pairing ultimately is what does John in. Nothing simpler than that. He makes a dish that Tom liked that ultimately, once you took a drink of the cocktail, which was a very basic cocktail, and then you had the dish again, it didn't pair well. And that's why John went home. So whether or not we were testing a skill that should have been tested or not, it was that skill or that issue which sent a really talented chef home at the final four here, a chef who had already made it to the final three. So I don't know. The proof may be in the cocktail, as it were, in this particular instance.
It's interesting that you say, like, nothing simpler than that, because this entire season we've been hearing from John, keep it simple, stupid. I mean, I want what works best for me is cooking really simple flavors. It's gotten me this far. But I was waiting for that other shoe to drop for, there to be a time where someone says, okay, it's simple, but is it too simple? And this was where it finally happened. I mean, Blaze is going to say when he first tries the dish, like, this cocktail is fine, but is it enough? And it seems like the answer is no, where it seems like they finally have reached a point where John is providing very simple flavors, but because everyone else has done much better with more complicated things, John has to suffer as a result.
I disagree completely. I mean, Blaze said the same simple comment about, you know, Brooke's dish. I mean, what sent John home, if it was purely being judged on the cocktail, surely your Sheldon would have gone home. They actually said, we liked John's cocktail better than Sheldon's or Shirley's. What killed him was exactly what Antonio had said. It wasn't that the cocktail was bad. It's just that when you paired the cocktail with the dish, at least Sheldon's and Shirley's complimented it somewhat, and the dish wasn't lost. When you drank John's cocktail, you completely lost any ability to appreciate his dish, and that's what killed it. It wasn't the cocktail itself. It wasn't the simplicity of the cocktail. It was the pairing with the dish that sent John.
I mean, it kind of was, though, because, I mean, they even say, like, the challenge was create a creative cocktail. And this is, again, the central conflict. We always come back to Top Chef. If you have someone who goes for gold and completely fails versus someone who sort of, like, sticks its state but doesn't necessarily fulfill the requirements of the challenge, who should go home? In this case, it turned out to be the latter. I agree, and there was a comment here and there about how, you know, with John's soup, like, the herbs weren't very fresh since he tried to cook them, so that was sort of lost. Tom tells this whole story about how I tried the soup, and then I tried the cocktail, and that washed out all the soup. So I definitely don't think it's purely from the cocktail, but it didn't help that it wasn't a very creative submission, as opposed to Shirley and Sheldon did not produce great alcoholic mixtures, but as you said, Kurt, they at least tried to be creative and tie it back into their dish, create something that you won't see at the top shelf of your bar.
Well, first he went for the Patron Silver, not the gold. Just want to clear
that's
that.
That's true. The second shelf. Second
yeah.
shelf.
But I still disagree. I think it was if he'd been able to have a simple cocktail that complemented the dish or enhanced the dish without necessarily being a complicated cocktail, like the fish tank that Sheldon had served, then I think he would. I don't think he was going to win necessarily, but I don't think he would have gone home. I think what really sent him home, and I don't think it was just a casual mention, it seemed to me when I watched the episode, is that what really sent him home was the fact that you completely lost the dish when drinking the cocktail. And so I think that's what the downfall was here. Not his ability to make a creative cocktail, but to make a cocktail that didn't basically kill any flavor in the dish.
It is certainly up for debate, and I think it's what's fascinating about it is John does make a simple cocktail. He wants it to be even simpler than it is. But of course, since Katsuji is a sous chef, Katsuji, even in the afterlife, finding ways to add ingredients to challenges, finding ways to make things more complicated, even though in this case it was probably a good thing. Katsuji's like, no, you need this. You need this. I want to add a prickly pear relish. I want to add this rimmer on the drink. We have to go to all these great lengths to add more ingredients to your dish, John, because that's what Katsuji does.
I was glad to see that. I was glad to see that there was – I was getting worried when I saw the simplicity of the cocktail. I like that there was a little bit of creativity around the rim. And I'm trying to remember, there was also something that topped the dish itself.
It was the prickly pear relish.
And the sweet and sour around the rim was complemented it, correct?
Yeah, I think that was all supposed to go together.
That was the impression I got.
Yeah, the problem was if that were true, then I'm not sure that Tom's comment would have stood, right? Because it would have complimented the dish rather than washing it out. And I don't know. I didn't get to taste it, didn't get to pair the two together. I do feel like Tom's comments ultimately are usually the ones that carry the day at judges' table. Most of the time, a chef doesn't go home that Tom wanted to save. Right, thankfully. Can we just talk about this? You mentioned it earlier. You said, Kurt, that Blaze made the same basic or Blasic comment that ultimately that he made to everybody. But we had some great questions and comments about this. I had some hilarious tweets from Katie on Twitter. A lot of other people wanted to talk about guest judge Richard Blaze really coming in hard at the chefs here. Mike, what's going on? Blasic comments aside, what's Richard Blaze doing at this judges' table?
So Sharon Tharp actually brought up something really interesting in the Rob Has a Podcast patron group. She said she actually interviewed Tom Colicchio recently, and he said something about how some guest judges like to throw shade just to get a good soundbite. And this, I apologize, Haley Strong and all the other Blaze lovers out there, but this is exactly what I don't like about Richard Blaze as a guest judge. And I'm sorry to be so negative over the course of this podcast,
No, do it. This because tee off on this one. It deserves the tee, for
because,
sure.
Because here's
no
the
tea,
thing.
No tea, all shade, Mike.
Yeah, no, only chamomile tea that Brooke uses on her goat ribs. But this is the problem that I have with Blaze, is that it feels like sometimes he's just overreaching to get a good soundbite. And I think this just comes from a bunch of experiences being on different food shows where they're like, okay, they're going to take a couple of good soundbites to use for promos or to use for the final edit at the end of the day, so I guess I better provide them. So that's why, you know, in season 12, we're getting these really out there metaphors. And here, he goes in a little bit of a different direction where at Judge's table, he calls out the winning dish by asking her if it was too safe at this point in the competition. Now, granted, he sort of, I guess, tries to backpedal a bit by saying, like, oh, no, I'm only saying that because I was at your spot in the competition before, because he has. He was a returning player during All-Stars who had made it to the finale but did not win, much like Shirley, Sheldon, and Brooke in this case. But it just did not come across well. It came across very callous to me. And you could even see it in Tom's reaction.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
His head snaps to him immediately when he says it. And it's weird also to sort of, you know, give those sorts of comments to a dish that everyone else lavishes with praise and ends up earning Brooke a win in a $7,500 bottle of tequila. It just came across as a little too mean and unnecessary to me.
Yeah, and these are chefs who, like, and most of these chefs have, like, you know, relationships outside of the show. I mean, Blaze and Brooke aren't strangers by any means. And so, like, this is probably, like, coming out of left field for everybody. And like you said, like, you had we talked about the Padma Sai eye. You had the Calicchio eye roll here in terms of, like, did Blaze really just say that? And I'm glad that Tom kind of, you know, gets him to backpedal a little bit in terms of, like, this the ridiculousness of the comment. I couldn't believe that actually went there.
It's difficult. The one of the comments that Katie had sent me on Twitter was essentially that Blaze is really thirsty to be a celebrity chef. And I think that that's right. I do think that that's correct. I think his sound bites position him as the front and center a lot of the time. And I think that that's what happened here. He said, like, oh, I'm only bringing this up because of me, because of me, because of what I did. And remember me, I was on Top Chef. I was on All-Stars. I won All-Stars. Remember that? And so I do think that there's a little bit of a sound bite, a desire there. I think it's difficult. I think it's a lot like when somebody from your class becomes teacher's assistant and then they have to act like they're somehow on a different level than you. And I don't mean to demean Richard Blaze's ability as a chef. He's a fantastic chef who cooked incredible food on Top Chef. But I think he feels the need to be extra judgy because he used to be a chef testant. So he has to come off as like, okay, let me show you my knowledge and validate me being here as a guest judge. And I think that that's probably what people don't like about Richard Blaze as a judge, is that he makes it about himself a little bit, that he seems to try to come off as overly critical just because he needs to show his valid reason for being a judge. Instead of just sliding in and talking about how the food was good, he really provides criticism. And you know what? Maybe we're really short shrifting him in that when you're a person who's creating something, you don't want everybody just blowing you up and sucking kneecaps the whole time. You want to hear pointed, constructive criticism. And maybe somebody like Richard Blaze, who has been in your shoes and understands what you're going through and can still provide that constructive criticism, is a way more valid judge than Rob freaking Gronkowski or, you know, the U.S. Surgeon General or whomever might be out there trying to provide feedback about your food. The fact that Richard Blaze was on Top Chef means that he's in some ways uniquely qualified to provide educated, like, I understand where you're coming from feedback. And yet that doesn't seem to be what we get from Richard Blaze.
Well, especially because, like, he does this and then he tongue bathes Shirley by being like, oh, I could take this salsa with a bag of chips and sit in a bubble bath and call it a day. And that, to me, I could totally understand if he was like,
what a weird life.
And what a weird life of Richard Blaze.
And yet, guess what I did last night, guys?
Same exact thing. Well, Richard Blaze, I'm assuming he loves foam, so I'm assuming a bubble bath would actually be perfect for him. But
nice.
It's tough because, like, if he wanted to apply constructive criticism, I think then it would sort of be across the board, right? You treat everyone kind of even-handedly. But for them to then go immediately go into, like, his crazy, weird metaphors that let us, you know, get some introspection into his daily life, this is sort of like the two sides of what I'm really, unfortunately, not liking about him at this point. And I agree with you, Antonio. I think he just needs to calm down and take a chill pill, you know? Trust the fact that you're a talented chef, you've been on TV before, you can produce good commentary, and just go with that. Don't feel like you need to create colorful metaphors to, you know, paint us with your language. Neither feel like you need to, you know, insult winning dishes by saying, like, oh, you should be doing better at this point in the competition. Just criticize the food, man.
And it was kind of like I brought up several weeks ago the Sporkful podcast that I listened to, that where they interviewed Padma, and like one of the things she says, like, our role as judges is also to paint a vivid visual picture of the dish so that the listeners can understand the experience that we had. And I think he needs to go back to focusing more on that as opposed to trying mm-hmm. to go for the sound bites, because I like Blaze personally. I'm in more in the Haley camp. I just found him insufferable in this episode as well.
If we could just get, like, Graham Elliott to wear a Richard Blaze costume and provide his Graham Elliott comments in a Richard Blaze face, then maybe everybody would be happy. I don't know. We're still not seeing Graham Elliott. It seems like this would have been a perfect time for him to show up. I don't know what's going on there. We've had a lot of theories sent our way. He's had surgery to aid in his weight loss. So there is a possibility that maybe he just can't eat all and drink all the things that he needs to do in the context of a judging kind of situation. We really don't know how much they eat ultimately, but a situation like that, when you have that surgery, you're limited in how much you can consume. So that's part of it. He's also a very busy guy, and he has his own brand, and so Top Chef was probably happy to get what they could get out of him, and that was that. Maybe he'll show up before the finale. Hopefully he will, but I'm not 100% sure. I don't think Tom has... It was weird. It reminded me of the movie The Departed, when Mark Wahlberg's character is just constantly berating Leonardo DiCaprio's character in a professional setting, and Mark Wahlberg's boss is Martin Sheen, and Martin Sheen's like, we're just going to have to get used to this guy. We're going to have to accept what a jerk he is. Tom is just kind of like, oh, good job, Brooke, for sticking up to that guy, like talking about Blaze, like they have to have him there. Like his annoying, like cloying, like angry feedback to Brooke is something they just all have to accept and get over. Like, no, like you don't have to have this guy on the show, Tom, if you don't like it. I loved how Tom shut him down and really just kind of dismissed with him. But that dismissal was sort of like, yeah, we just kind of have to deal with this guy. No, don't have him on the show if you don't like it. Like, so it will be interesting to see going forward if this is something where, like what Sharon Tharp said, like Tom is enjoying getting this sort of feedback and really likes these sound bites because they make the show feisty or whatever. And maybe he doesn't enjoy it. Maybe he just said some guest judges like to do it. But it really you shouldn't. I feel like it's one of those like be heard and not seen, or like you're supposed to provide your feedback, but you should not be the star or a character in this drama. You should just be a person who shows up to provide feedback if you're a guest judge. And Richard Blaze insists on making himself one of the dramatis personae, and I just don't know ultimately if we need that especially at this stage of the game, right? Like, I don't know. He seems like he has really good feedback about the food generally speaking, when he's like, this needed more salt to me, or I didn't think this ate well, but I thought that was really an odd swipe at Brooke to start the feedback. That's the winning dish. What a weird thing to do. It really didn't look good for Richard. He looked worse than Katsuji on this episode.
That's saying something. we should talk about the winning dish too, and sort of segue into, I know we talked about John's dish a bit, but the other three, I mean, Brooke is again not only showing her newfound confidence coming back from LCK, but also a little bit of ingenuity here too, where I think initially she said she wanted to go for a tuna dish, but the tuna wasn't the exact cut that she wanted when they went to the store. So instead she subs it out for coconuts, even though it's a much more laborious process to get the coconut meat out. As a result, she's able to produce a winning dish despite not having a protein, which I feel like is fantastic. So, I mean, I said at the very beginning of this podcast, but Brooke is really coming out as a raging Gale Storm, not a Gale Simmons storm, of a force here in the first stages of the finals.
Yeah, she. I think her dish, as much as John's dish looked absolutely gorgeous last week, I thought Brooke's dish looked just about as gorgeous this week. The hibiscus margarita looked amazing. Everything about her dish just looked incredible. The idea that she would pivot from tuna to coconut is just really, as you point out, Mike, the ingenuity is there. The soup was refreshing. The sweet and the acid balance, the combination of the drink, the citrus. She used burnt onion and avocado oil in the drink. Like, I have to have all this stuff. It looked really phenomenal. And I just am fascinated by how all that played out. And it just looked like a winning dish from the jump. That's why the feedback seems so odd. I loved how she pushed back and stood up really, really well for it. Basically saying, like, that was a labor intensive dish. And the fact that it was simple meant it had to be inch perfect. And that is very stressful, and you can only imagine the level of that went into it. And this is Brooke really on display here, not only showing confidence at this stage of the game, but really showing incredible chef work in terms of what she did. I thought her dish looked fantastic. It made sense to me why it won. So if the job of Top Chef is to convey that, I think mission accomplished in that respect. Kurt, did you like Brooke's dish?
I did, and I think one of the things that impressed me there was we've often seen chefs have to adapt on the fly when they go shopping at Whole Foods, or in this case, Fresca, and the ingredient that they want isn't there, and then they kind of are forced into a new hand. And this was a case where they had tuna, but you know, in assessing the tuna, Brooke saw, like, this isn't the quality that I want. This isn't the level of tuna that I should be serving at this stage in the game. So I'm making the choice to figure out what's an alternative plan rather than kind of settle for this lower grade tuna. And so I thought that. That was also, I think, an impressive part for me was rather than kind of go easy with what she had wanted, she really kind of at least maintained her own standards in terms of the ingredients she was expecting and looked for an alternative plan because of that. And so I think that was something that I found also to be impressive, the fact that she wasn't forced into this, but that she kind of chose her way into this thoughtfully and with much consideration. So I thought that was also impressive for me.
I mean, we're at a stage of the game where everyone that's left, obviously, as we've gone on and on about, is impressive, and that they all can do impressive work. And we shouldn't sell anyone short. We talked a lot about John's dish, but he really decided to honor the workers there. He cooked a working man's soup, essentially, and that maybe some people said was safe, but I felt like John made a really good point. Tom said, is it more important than winning to do justice to the people that were here and what you were trying to do? And John said, I think the two go hand in hand. And I think that there's a lot of fairness in that, that he is trying to do the best he can by the people that work there, the people that the challenge is geared at, even though if that feels safe, this is something where they really were pleased with what happened there. He didn't go into that party for the workers of that event and cook a dish that was maybe something that they had never even conceived of or that was over their head. He cooked a very, as Tom pointed out, a good dish that Tom liked that was in their realm. That was a working man's kind of soup. And so that was safe in many respects, but also honorable and good.
It reminds me a little bit of the kind of the undertones of like the challenges where they've had to cook for Boston's finest in terms of like the police force, and there you're kind of looking to serve a dish that not necessarily honors them but is at least touches down on some elements that are like that they're accustomed to. You're not going to be cooking high cuisine, not because it's out of their range, but because you want to get something that is at least relatable to the people who are eating and something that they're going to find recognizable and be able to form an opinion on and kind of put word, like, you know, be able to compare it to something that they've had before. So I actually really respected that choice by him.
I think that's a really excellent observation. And I think that's the challenge. That's a difficulty when you face a challenge like this. And it's something that comes up on Top Chef a lot. Do you cook for the judges or do you cook for the audience? And if you're cooking for the audience, how do you make it so that the judges really still respect what you're doing? If the audience is not maybe the most adventurous in terms of their eating habits, and how do you make a dish that is refined when you're talking about an audience that maybe doesn't prefer refined dishes? So how do you please the judges and the audience at the same time? I actually felt like the show made it seem like John struck a pretty good note with that. The thumbs up from Colicchio is really all that John's dish needed from me to see seem like, okay, he made the right call in that respect. Like, he did a good job of honoring the people that were there, but also cooking a dish that was well-liked. It is a bold choice at the Final Four to cook a dish that might be seen as safe, and we heard the feedback from Richard about that, so we won't get into it anymore. It didn't seem like either of those dishes were safe to me. I'm not a really high-end chef or anything like that. But guys, we didn't even get a really good discussion of sous viding, our mom's angry neighbor last week, in terms of the accuracy of what sous vide does. And we can get into that a little bit before we wrap up. But that said, it seemed like those dishes were complex to me, and they seemed like they ate really well. Mike, I'm curious, talking about one of the other dishes, what the heck went on with Sheldon's dish? Because it sure seemed like Sheldon was really worried that he'd hammered his octopus into the point where the texture was going to be bad and there was no good way to fix it. And yet we didn't hear any negative feedback. We heard the octopus was cooked perfectly. Did I miss something there?
No, it seems like that's sort of like a Top Chef trope a bit. We talk about with Amazing Race where before the commercial break, if a team is in trouble after the commercial break, things will be resolved just fine. And even last week, the commercial break was Sheldon saying, oh no, my California gold rice, you know, hasn't congealed. I can't form these noodles. What should I do? After the commercial break, he fixes it. We didn't get the second half of the equation here. And, you know, when they're trying the dishes, I forget if it's the guest judge or Blaze says that the octopus is cooked great. So we don't know exactly how Sheldon was able to MacGyver his way into having his octopus be fine. Maybe it's just the fact that his fish tank drink was so much the detractor from everything else that the octopus consistency didn't matter at the end of the day.
I like how they described it as a guava salad with some alcohol poured on top.
I thought he tried to stand up for that that issue there. And I thought it was funny when he was basically like, look, I'm making a really – and again, I think it ties into what we were talking about, right? The issue with this challenge when you're cooking for an audience that may be if you cook the most refined dish you could make is not going to resonate as well with them. And Sheldon said, like, look, my dish was really refined. So I wanted the cocktail to just be muddled. Like I wanted, and I don't mean that muddled in terms of like muddled, like mixed up, like the actual like term of art muddled, where you're muddling a fruit and you're slamming it down like you make an old fashioned or whatever. Like he wanted that to be a different presentation than his dish, because his dish seemed like it was very refined, so he thought that contrast would be good, even as the flavors would come together and do really well. And actually, it does seem like the sloppy cocktail was really the big issue with Sheldon's dish. Maybe it ate a little sweet for some of the judges, but it wasn't enough to get Sheldon sent home. It also wasn't as good as Brooke's dish enough such that he was really right there for the win. But it seemed like it was well-liked in terms of the dish itself. Shirley's dish was also well-liked. Her salsa was apparently excellent.
Her salsa was well-liked.
Her salsa was what if her dish wasn't well-liked, Kurt? The invisible whipped cream, was that it?
Yeah, the fact that Silva had meant to pick up some, was asked to pick up some bottles of blue agave nectar and accidentally ended up with Mexican vanilla, and Shirley's like, oh, happy accident. And just basically just decided, you know, let's see how this goes, and decides, you know what, it actually goes well with the dish that you know she tries to combine the charred beef with this Mexican vanilla, and apparently the judges do not agree. In fact, there's kind of a big question mark as to like where is that invisible whipped cream.
Mike, is this something you're familiar with, like steak with vanilla flavors?
My God, I am like gagging just thinking about it. Just because I love steak, I love whipped cream. Maybe they shouldn't be together. The other big note of criticism on Shirley's part goes back to the cocktail. It's not as much of a green and stormy as Sheldon's was, but Tom really sticks it to Shirley for saying that her cocktail was very thick and needed to be strained more. So I feel like between that and the vanilla beef, which again sounds really gross even just saying it, I feel like Shirley might have finished number three out of these four. And granted, you know, had some things happen with John and he produced, you know, he'd done a bunch of different things, maybe we could have seen a situation of Shirley going home, which would have been sad, because I think
that's where I thought things were going to, that's where I thought things were going to be going, was that I thought Shirley was going to go home between the thick drink and the vanilla beef.
And that would have kind of sucked because, I mean, aside from the drink alone, one of the reasons why Shirley would have gone home is because her sous chef accidentally picked up the wrong ingredient.
She would have gone home because she insisted on using the ingredient and thought it was a good pairing and it wasn't. She didn't have to. She said, you know what? Let's try this. Oh, this does work. That's why it wouldn't have been Silva's fault.
I feel like vanilla beef is also a good way to describe Richard Blase's Blasic comments of all these issues that he has. It's just kind of vanilla beef with everybody.
I have had a burger that has had whipped cream on it before, and it was interesting. It wasn't bad, but it was something that if I hadn't known it was going to be there, it would have definitely thrown me for a loop. So I'd be interested in trying a kind of skirt steak that has a vanilla finish to it, but I'd want to know going into it that that's what I was getting.
Yeah, it definitely seemed to surprise people. And I mean, of course, it was a happy accident surprise for Shirley as well. And she tried to look, when life gives you vanilla, you make vanilla steak. That's what the old aphorism is.
Not the phrase.
So ultimately, that's I felt bad in that seemed like it certainly could have been the sort of thing that sent her home. It doesn't sound like it was that bad. It just sounded like it was something that did stand out and not in a good way. So it might have been enough to send her home if everything with John's dish had been perfect, but it sounded like the cocktail really washing out the flavor of John's soup. It was a pairing challenge, and the pairing there just really did not bring it home. And so that ultimately did seem to be why John went home, not as what I thought, which is that when he served his dish, he was literally douched with sweat, like he was covered in sweat. Like, I don't know. I'm sure it's hot in Mexico, and John was working double time, and dealing with Katsuji is enough of a reason to sweat your face off there. But it was a tough day, it looked like, for John there in Mexico, and tough to see him go home here. It really is something that I think John's story this season was a redemption arc. I do think that we got the story that John really deserved coming into this season with a new mindset. We saw him cook with his wife, which had to be a really great moment for John. We saw him talk a lot about his family. We saw him talk a lot about this commitment that he'd made. It was a long story in this season. Of Chef John putting the most hated chef in Dallas and all of this stuff, the negativity on his previous season behind him, and really trying to rise above it all. And of course, that happened in microcosm in this episode. And so I guess in some level, it makes sense that this is the one he went home in. And I'm sad to see him go. We've talked a couple of weeks ago how we were in a kill your darlings position here with Top Chef, and that once we got to a certain point, literally every person that was left was a chef we were rooting for. I think that's definitely the case here to see a chef we were rooting for go home. I think that's a difficult thing. And it is something that I thought ultimately was bittersweet. And maybe that's two of the flavor profiles we saw in the dishes. But it was bittersweet in that I felt like it was a good ending for John, even though it felt a little premature, and that I'm sure he wanted to go farther into the competition. But top three is nothing to sneeze at, and especially in a season where the talent is this high. So really enjoyed watching John this season. And really enjoyed seeing his food. Kurt, I understand you're going to be eating it very, very soon here.
Yeah, I'm actually getting a chance to. I'm going to be in Dallas for work this coming week, and so I'm going to take an opportunity to check out to Knife Dallas and get some meat in me.
I've heard nothing but good
things.
Once
again, cheerfully withdrawn.
Cheerfully withdrawn. Yes, Mike, just by saying I pass, you're basically making the comment. So you
listen, I'm allowing the listeners
away.
To use their imaginations to create any sort of comments that they think I would say. It's a play-at-home game of the Top Chef podcast.
I'm not sure anyone signed up for that.
Did you think going to the season that John was going to be rivaling Sheldon for most cuddly chef of the season? Because that's kind of where he ended up.
Yeah, it's it was very surprising. It was a good story that was told this season. His age did not hold him back in any way, but it was a story that he himself was telling from the jump. The old guy, calling Sam us old guys. We got to laugh about it at first. And he's referencing Steely Dan to start this episode. So this is something where his age was a thing, but he even comments in his like parting remarks. Like, a lot of chefs his age are doing the thing where they're just pressing the flesh. They're not really back in the kitchen working it. And John's proud of that fact. I think he acquitted himself incredibly well
exhibit,
on his return.
Exhibit A, Richard Blase.
Yeah. Well, no comment. No comment. But yeah, he did really well, I think, this season to really change the story and the theme of him on Top Chef. I think if you were talking about this season in the Survivor terms, Survivor had a second chance season where the narrative of everyone's second chance on the show to play the game of their lifetime was a huge narrative for them. In some cases, they were weighed down with the responsibility of it. In some cases, they rose above it. I think John did really well with his second chance. The only thing he could have really done better with it was win. But I think that he didn't need to win to have redemption, and I think he got that. So shout out to John for that for this season. I thought it was really good to see him on this season. And it's no shame in losing this final four competition to these three chefs who are left, who are all just in various ways crushing it this season. And I'm just fascinated and excited to see where we go next. We're going to go to a resort in Mexico, which is very different, I think, from some of the things we've seen in the past from Top Chef in Mexico. We've seen the more rustic aspects of the challenge. We've seen artisans and artists in different areas. We've now seen Guadalajara, which seems to be this really kind of up-and-coming food scene that is being presented on the show. And we've got the high highs of the Hacienda at Patron, but the people who work there are what were described as working men. So we really covered the gamut here in Guadalajara. We are going to live the resort lifestyle. We're going to be in the Yucatan Peninsula, the whole Mayan aspect of it. I'm really fascinated to see what we do next in Mexico. There's a lot. I mean, Top Chef, it seems like, could go to Mexico every finale, and I wouldn't be disappointed. And so I'm really excited to see what we've got coming up. What else do we need to talk about from this episode that we haven't hit yet? Mike, anything from questions from the listeners, or Kurt, any larger topics you want to discuss?
So I want to talk about two quick things and then maybe get to one or two questions. One, I cannot sweep this comment under a bushel. Sheldon's lovable moment of the episode, which maybe should become like a recurring segment, is definitely his confessional about talking about being allergic to tequila. It causes him to break out into dance, and that was just such, like, I love, it's so corny, such a dad joke, but that is my style of humor, and I love the delivery of it and just the smile that creeps out at the end. It's something that, for someone who more so relishes chugging 30 beers out of the back of a truck, it was super cute for him to say. Other thing that I will say, you know, we've obviously been talking about LCK, that's over now, but I do want to pimp out one BravoTV.com exclusive thing that everyone should check out, or at least people that are interested in any behind the scenes looks. There is like an interesting little like 3.5 minute behind the scenes look in this episode where you see the executive producer, the line producers, production people, everything doing things behind the scenes during these challenges. There's a couple of interesting things that happens. For example, the production control room loses power. The executive producer talks about how this, the idea from this challenge came from National Tequila Day. But I it was really, really interesting, at least for me, to see how the sausage, or in this case, the margaritas, get made. So I highly encourage anyone who wants to check it out, go to bravotv.com/topchef. It should be on there. Really interesting look behind the scenes at this episode.
And it's only a few minutes. It's only a few minutes, right?
Yeah, only like 3.5 minutes long.
That brings up an interesting point. I'm sure I know. I think that you and I have talked about the TV show Unreal before, Antonio. And I can't remember, yes, Mike, if you've seen it, but I know that's a reality show. It's a drama that takes place behind the scenes of a Bachelor like reality show. It'd be interesting if in future seasons they shifted away from the dating shows and into like what the drama might be like behind the scenes of a cooking show or behind the scenes of a Survivor like show. So completely off topic, but just something that popped into my head. Bookmark that.
Well, and Magical Elves makes some interesting series besides Top Chef. It's not like all their shows are maybe as reputable, I should say, as Top Chef. Project Greenlight is one of theirs, and that is that's a big one, no doubt about it. And they used to make Project Runway, I think. Is that correct? And then they've changed, and since they don't do that anymore, I'm not sure about that. But I think they make a show called Cold Justice, which is not in the same realm.
Why am I picturing like a big tin sheriff's star like shooting up onto the screen as part of the Cold Justice title sequence?
I mean, that's kind of where we're at with that. I mean, if you go and check like the profile for Cold Justice, it's it's certainly a hot button issue. I won't get into that anymore. They make Braxton Family Values, which is a show I've heard about and not seen. And I don't mean to be trash talking. I just mean to say, like, a lot of their shows don't seem to be the level of Top Chef. So maybe there is more interesting things going behind the scenes at Magical Elves. I think they made a Cam Newton reality show. I don't know. I just think that there are some interesting things with the shows they make. So it was kind of cool to see the behind the scenes with the people that were making the show. It's not like the Food and Wine. It's not like Dana Cowan or the new editor in chief of Food and Wine, who I apologize, whose name is escaping me. It's not like it's high level foodies that are sitting backstage, really just kind of directing it. The producers are probably the judges on some level, and then you've got the people that are just making a TV show. And I think it was cool to see them in the background because their focus, right, is a little bit different. They're talking about, let's make sure the TV show comes off. Let's get the mariachi band in here. Let's get the lights going in the right way. Let's really make this look the way that it should for a good TV show to happen. They're not focusing as much on how to make the food part of that work in terms of that. I mean, we talked about how the judges feel like that's their responsibility to talk that out and to make those dishes pop off the screen. So it's really interesting to see the behind the scenes aspect of that, to see how the show about how the sausage gets made, see how that sausage gets made. So that is a really interesting thing to me too as well, Mike, and I thought that really well really is worth checking out. Kurt, what about you? Anything else you want to talk about from this episode?
No, I'm looking forward to going to. I think we just have two more episodes left. I was looking at my DVR and the description from for episode 14, which is 2 weeks out. Very much just from it looks like it's kind of down to the final meal, the final two, bringing back sous chefs. So we're going to see some additional faces on the screen, but I think we've got two more to go, and hopefully we'll get all of us together at some point before that.
Yeah, I think that should definitely happen, and we have two more to go, so we'll certainly hit it before the end of the season with an all four. But before we wrap this one up, we have a couple other things to talk about, Mike. I know you wanted to hit a couple questions.
So I got this one question from Steve that I think would be really interesting to posit to you guys, especially when we were just talking about Richard Blaise and his history and his effect on maybe the stuff this episode. But he said, could you see any of these three chefs becoming a semi-regular judge a la Blaise? I'm going to expand this net a little bit to cover, you know, anybody from Top Chef past, because I think it would be interesting to see someone like Sheldon or Shirley or Brooke become a semi-regular judge. But I think what Top Chef is looking for is someone who has TV experience as well. I personally think if the Chew should go under, Carla Hall has a permanent guest judge seat here on Top Chef, because now that she has the presentational experience as well as her electric personality and the cooking skills to boot, I feel like she'd be in a perfect spot. But do you guys have any other thoughts as to other Top Chef alumni that could fill the Richard Blaise spot of former chef testant turned guest judge?
I think that's a great one. I think that's a great first draft pick. I'm not sure. Kurt, don't say Philip. Don't say Philip.
No. I was going to say Nick.
Oh, I'm just thinking, or Carl, right? Like any, I was just thinking of white men that had been on the show. Yeah.
And so people who have first-hand experience with vanilla, so they can comment on the vanilla beef. There's nobody that pops to mind from this season. Looking back on previous seasons, again, goldfish memory, maybe, and just because he's a personality and he's verging into that ability to, you know, have commented on things, I actually wouldn't mind seeing Marcel back in that role, to be completely honest. He's a bit off the radar for a long time. I could also actually see, I was going to say Stefan, but maybe not.
Wow, man, that would be abrasive, right? Like, yeah.
If we're throwing shade at Richard Blaise for, like, saying this comment to Brooke, Stefan would do 10 times worse to someone that won a challenge.
But I actually watched Marcel's show, Quantum Kitchen, thank you. I knew it was something kitchen, and I actually liked it.
I liked it.
Yeah. So I wouldn't mind seeing more Marcel.
I think that on that same realm, I think you lean a little too hard into it. If you put someone like Mike Isabella up there, you know, Mike Isabella
has hot takes. Mike Isabella will be on there. Like, we have a Mike Isabella affiliated person every season, so it would be unfair inherently.
Well, that's a good point.
And on that, Antonia actually would be good. She,
Antonia would be great. Yeah,
and I've part of it's because I've seen her many times on Cutthroat Kitchen, and I know that she can actually has the presenting chops and the ability to kind of handle that role. I think she. So I've seen her in that judging capacity before. So I think actually Antonia would be a really good addition.
Yeah, there are definitely people. I mean, we saw Michael Voltaggio come back this season, and that makes a lot of sense because we've seen him in that sort of role, and this is something where he, I think, is a head and shoulders kind of guy, where he is his talent is really. I mean, he was probably like maybe in his late 20s or early 30s when he was on Top Chef, but he was a phenom. Like, he was really just the kind of guy that jumped right off the screen talent wise, but his personality wasn't always there. He wasn't a Carla Hall. Like, he didn't have the magnetic personality that immediately pulled you in the way like a Fabio would or someone like that. He was just like almost like single-handedly dedicated to his craft in a way that was a little bit intimidating. And I thought he did a great job as a guest judge on this season. I didn't think we had really too many negative comments about him that weren't related to his short sleeve chef coat. So at the end of the day, I think that he shows that you can be a really intense chef as well and yet still be fair in this guest judge role. So I think the door is open for people that aren't just people who present well, that cook good food, but I don't think you can be abrasive. And I also don't think, I like one of my favorite personalities on Top Chef in of all time is Isaac Toups. I think Isaac Toups is a Cajun chef, and I think that you run the risk of having him be a guest judge in a season where that doesn't really come into play a lot, and would he really have a lot to say? Or would he have as much to say as somebody else that you could pick? I'm not sure about that. So there are some personalities that really wouldn't play well. I'd kind of like to see Dale Talley in that role, because he was always sort of non-plussed with what was going on, and in downright angry in his first season, but we saw a sort of a John Tesar like character arc from Dale Taldy when he came back on All Stars in terms of putting that to bed and in terms of maturing as a chef. So maybe as a guest judge he would be even more interesting. That guy, I'm always fascinated to hear about what that guy's got going on, because he opens restaurants and closes them. He just seems to have like really interesting concepts. I'd like to hear more from Dale Taldy in Top Chef. I'd like to see more of him. So there are a lot of possibilities there, none of which are Richard Blaise. So maybe we have to fix that. It's difficult. What other questions do we have? Anything else we need to hit before we wrap this up?
Real quick fan favorite update, just because I've been doing it the past couple weeks. We are down to four. Going in order, we have Sheldon, Jim, Brooke, and Shirley. That's what the rankings were in the middle of the episode. I think we said this last week, but again, good on Jim's and, you know, the Jim's fans for someone who went out in 10th place being able to be currently second in the fan favorite ranking. I think that just shows how much of a positive, sunny personality Jim was. I'm not sure if we're going to... I think we're going to narrow it down to two next week, and then, assuming what Kurt said, if 2 weeks from now is the finale, they'll declare the winner there. So we'll see. It might become a Sheldon versus Jim's showdown, or maybe Brooke or Shirley will sneak their way in there, but that's just a quick fan favorite update.
It's a fascinating thing. Jim's did not get a finale bump. He did not get to pop up as one of the sous chefs. He's not in the finale. So to see him at this level in the fan favorite voting, I think should really be shouting to Bravo. Like, this is someone who, as viewers of the show, people loved. And if you're going to bring back a second chance season, this is somebody that's got to get the call right away. Like, this is just somebody that the fans want to see more of. We are still voting for him, even though he's not really present on the TV screens. We don't forget. People don't forget. So shout out to Jim's for that incredible run. He's doing really well in that voting. And as I said, vote with your heart. Vote who you want to vote for in this final four. It's just really heartwarming to see a chef who I think we all love seeing on the screen, who got eliminated in the midway part of this competition, still really popping in this fan favorite voting at the end of the season. So I really am happy to see that outcome. And I hope that's a note to Bravo that people really liked Chef Jim and would like to see him back on Top Chef in another season. And so I'm happy to see that in the voting. I do also want to give one update. Chris Ashley sent me a really good message message on Twitter at YouthGuyCash. Chris talked about our sous vide-ing last week where we really didn't know the full details of sous vide. It's just not something I do at home and have not had a lot of experience with. But it is something you can do at home. The machines aren't that expensive, Chris said, and he actually got one for Christmas and has used it a bunch. It's heating the water around the sealed package so that you've got an even cook. It can take longer, and then you take the meat out. You can make a really great steak or cut of meat. Chris talked about by sous vide-ing these things, and that was ultimately, I think, what we saw Brooke working on last week, and we weren't sure what went wrong with the dish. And it doesn't sound like the sous vide failed, per se. It should be a cooking method which cooks something evenly, but there may have been a timing element in play there, which is, I think, a little bit of what we talked about. So sorry if we let anybody down with the under-informative sous vide discussion. I think we were caught up in sous videing our mother's angry neighbor. Speaking of hashtags, what do you guys think should be a hashtag for this episode of this podcast?
I can't get past goatball sub from early on.
You can't. You're still hung up. No vanilla beef for
Kurt? I had corn smut. I had vanilla beef, but I really like goatball sub. We could go with any of those. Vanilla beef's fine too. Let's go with vanilla beef.
What about you, Mike? I'm a little worried about goatball sub. Kurt,
I am as well. There's probably some NSFW affiliations in there, even, you know, especially when goats get involved. So maybe vanilla beef would be a safer, more vanilla route to go, if you will.
All right, so let's use the hashtag vanilla beef if you want to talk about this episode of this podcast on social media. You can tweet using the hashtag vanilla beef. You can always tweet at us with your thoughts and comments and send any messages along the way that you'd like. I am at AC Mazzaro with two Z's and one R on Twitter. Mike, you are at A Mike Bloom type, and Kurt, you are at Kurt Clark. Is that correct, guys?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, so you can tweet at us. Let us know what you thought about this episode, your thoughts about next week's episode as you watch it, any questions or comments you have about the season in general. We're winding up, guys. Just two episodes to go. We will be back next week to talk about these two episodes of Top Chef as they happen, one next week, one the week following. We're going to be here through the end of the season, maybe even a wrap up. We'll see how that goes. But we'll be covering, as long as Top Chef's on the air this season, we'll be covering it with a podcast every week. Anything else, guys?
Nope.
All right. Well, thank you guys once again for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.